I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, what your child may be doing in school today if he or she is part of a massive teach-in on global warming. But first, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, John McCain, Mitt Romney, and Mike Huckabee and Ron Paul turn their attention to California today, where they're all campaigning ahead of Super Duper Tuesday next week when voters in 22 states cast their ballots. Aides to Republican Mitt Romney say he could shell out as much as $7 million in new ads. He's already spent $40 million on his campaign. But the political earth shook today with the news that Democrat Barack Obama raised $32 million in the single month of January. Aides say Obama's strongest money-raising day was after losing the New Hampshire primary. He heads into tonight's final Democratic Party debate before Tuesday with a huge financial surge. Joining us on the line, David Hawkins, managing editor of Congressional Quarterly Weekly. And first of all, what do you make of the ads? Karl Rove writes in today's Wall Street Journal that television ads don't matter as much as they used to. Your thoughts?
Wow, that's an interesting observation. I think that's an interesting point because I think that this year there's sort of two kinds of media in the political world, right? There's paid media, is what the politicians call ads, and earned media, which is essentially getting on the news. And there has been so much news this time. There's really been an ample opportunity for voters to see in debates. And in plenty of debates, 15 Republican debates, I think an equal number of Democratic debates, plenty of time for these candidates to get their own messages out and for voters to figure it out themselves. So I think in that sense, the ads may have faded in importance.
Well, some have said that John McCain is the one who gets the earned media. Mitt Romney supporters, Mike Huckabee supporters say that John McCain gets more of the airtime. But others would point out that the sort of right-wing talk radio machinery has been trouncing John McCain and supporting Mitt Romney.
That's true. I think that it's probably also the case that the right-wing talk radio is a narrower segment of the population than the sort of general interest cable TV news, where McCain has done actually quite well and where his straight talk express notion does get him a lot more airtime, or has traditionally gotten him more airtime. Now it will be for the next week. I would bet that minute for minute you'll see these two on the air almost exactly as much.
Well, let's take a look at tonight's final debate before Tuesday between the two top standing Democrats, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Yesterday, Obama said a Clinton presidency would be a step back to the 20th century. Clinton said Obama was being more audacious than hopeful. That's a reference to his book, The Audacity of Hope. Mm-hmm. What do you expect the points to be or the tone to be tonight, especially after last night's sparring match between largely Mitt Romney and John McCain?
Well, I think the dynamic changes obviously profoundly when it's just two people on the stage, even from when it's three people on the stage. The most recent debate, Senator Edwards was still in it. Just the two of them and the moderators, the tone of it, I think, will probably begin quite frostily. I think that the two are annoyed with one another. There is this tension in the air. That tension was pretty palpable on State of the Union night when those of us watching on TV got to see this incredibly awkward moment of Senator Hillary Clinton reaching out to shake hands with Ted Kennedy, who had just endorsed Obama a few hours earlier. Obama took that moment. Obama was standing right there and either by coincidence or purposefully turned away to talk to somebody else. He says he was asked a question. There's some skepticism that he might have looked and asked to be asked a question so he wouldn't have to face Hillary Clinton face-to-face. They're frosty.
And voters want to hear about the issues, but these things, these moments become important as we, get to the end zone here. Quick question. I'm looking at the demographics of the three Democratic frontrunners as they left New Hampshire and Iowa. These were printed in the National Journal. The breakdown indicates that John Edwards supporters line up far more with Hillary Clinton's than with Barack Obama's. Obama supporters tend to declare themselves far more liberal than Clinton and Edwards supporters. And another number jumps out. Edwards had huge support, 42% among conservatives. Obama and Clinton, 21 and 22%. What do you take from that? Do we know where Edwards supporters are going yet?
Well, we don't know where Edwards supporters are going yet, and Senator Edwards himself hasn't endorsed anybody. But I think what is safe to say is, given the message of Edwards' own campaign, which was about change and about going away from the status quo and about not doing business as usual in Washington, in political shorthand, that seems clearly a pointed reference much more to an anti-Hillary Clinton candidacy and for a Barack Obama candidacy. So I would say that the message anyway that Edwards was trying to drive home was that Hillary Clinton was too much business as usual. And so I can't imagine that if he does endorse anybody, that he would endorse anybody other than Barack Obama.
David Hawkins, managing editor of Congressional Quarterly Weekly, thanks for giving us this sort of snapshot of where we are in the presidential race ahead of tonight's debate between the top two Democrats, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. David, thanks.
Nice to be with you.
Bush administration officials are holding international global warming talks in Hawaii today, while students and teachers at 1,500 schools and colleges across the country are taking part in a massive teach-in focused on climate change. College students at Missouri State are trucking in 15 tons of coal to demonstrate what it takes to power their school for an hour. At Boston Latin School here in Boston, students are marking walls inside the school with blue tape to indicate where the water line would be if melting ice were to raise to the sea level 20 feet as predicted. The teach-in is called Focus the Nation. Some schools are not participating. In a few minutes, we'll hear about a town in Montana where parents say teaching or lecturing on the topic of global warming is indoctrination. But first, two young women who are organizing Focus the Nation teach-in events at their schools. 15-year-old Katie Schmidt is a ninth grade student at the Greenwich Country Day School in Connecticut. Katie, hi.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. And we have Smitha Ramakrishna. She's 16 and a high school junior in Phoenix, Arizona. She won the President's Environmental Youth Award last year and already has a lot of activism under her belt, including founding a global youth alliance. Smitha, welcome to you as well.
Hi, thank you so much.
And let's start with you. What are you doing for this teach-in?
We in our high school are organizing a benefit concert. It's a concert for conservation. And all the money that's going to be raised from this concert is going to be donated to the Conservation Fund, and they buy land, especially in Texas and California, and they kind of, since that now becomes private land, it's kind of secured from industries coming and trying to bulldoze that land.
They preserve it.
Right.
Katie, what is your school doing?
Well, at our school, we actually had the opportunity to not have classes. Students are not allowed to drive cars to school. We're having them take the bus. We're having them walk, ride their bikes. We're trying to carpool, so we're saying if you live too far away or you actually can't walk or do those kind of things, you can carpool with friends. So it will conserve energy.
Yep. You've asked kids to have a waste-free school lunch. What does that mean?
We're having our whole school, nursery through ninth grade, bring in their own lunches. No garbage, no plastic. No garbage cans, so you have to eat everything you have.
Or carry it out, as they say.
Right.
Smitha, did I hear you in the background say awesome when you heard some of the when you heard some of these things Katie was saying?
Yeah, that's really cool.
Well,
yeah.
You know,
I was just asking Smitha, like, was it a controversy in your school with the teachers to try to come up with what you guys were going to do, or were they pretty?
Oh, no. Well, actually, our administration was actually really supportive of our issue because we are a club in our school, and So it was like a club activity, so it was okay to have it like outside of school because it wasn't part of the school curriculum or anything.
And I'm wondering, Smitha, you know, if you in particular have these concerns about how can you read, it's sort of like preaching to the choir a little bit if it's kids who are already, you know, doing some of these things. And I know that you were influenced to become an activist after you traveled to India and saw kids there that didn't have, what, clean water, was it?
Yeah. In 2004, I went to India, and I was really affected because I went and I saw children who were my age who didn't even have access to clean water. And it really opened my eyes to that maybe whatever I do here in Arizona might affect children across the world and kind of open my eyes to a more global perspective. And you were talking about preaching to the choir. Well, I feel like it's not really preaching to the choir because however many times you say you have to conserve energy, you have to conserve water, every time you say it's important because maybe it'll change one person's mind in the audience, and that's a big difference.
Yeah. And Katie, I shouldn't assume that everybody's, you know, all on board. Was there discussion ahead of time? I mean, were there people who, you know, maybe didn't want to do this?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was some people who maybe were opposed to it because they wanted to teach and they didn't want, like, they wanted every opportunity they can. But I think that we came to a conclusion as a school that this was what we need to do to make a difference. And I think that now everyone is really excited about it, and there really isn't any more opposition.
Yeah. How do you feel, you know, organizers of the Focus on the Nation teach-in events today say all the events are organized locally, there's no prescribed curriculum, they just came up with the idea of do something. And yet, the critics have said that this is indoctrination. Smitha, your thoughts on that? I mean, will there be any discussion of whether or not there is a man-made climate change, or are you going to, you know, are you going to allow for that because that's what some of the critics have said, or, you know, or do you think that's already been resolved?
Well, I don't really know if you can say this is an indoctrination, because really it's basically this forum trying to bring people together, and it doesn't matter what causes the climate change, because I think that's really the main issue, what's causing the climate change. Is it humans? Is it not? But there is some type of climate change going on, and Focus Nation is just an effort to encourage discussion on the solution to this issue, what everyday individuals can do, what societies can do, even on the national scale. So,
well, I'm looking at some of the things that are being done today. Wesleyan is serving a sustainable dinner. Kids at an elementary school in California are using worms to compost the remains of their lunches. Well, Smitha, you've been a youth representative to environmental conferences in San Francisco and Mexico. You've formed a global youth group with UN advisors. I mean, you're a pro at this point in 16. How do you win over a kid who says, you know what, I got my skateboard, and I'll see you later?
Yeah. Well, there's definitely a lot of them. But, I mean, it was really hard to, I guess, get people motivated and kind of convey my passion. But I think that really what you have to do is you have to sell it like a product, because, I mean, I know this is a weird analogy, but it's sort of like a business, because you have to show how they can benefit. And showing the success stories really kind of pushes people to the edge where they kind of say, oh, well, maybe I should join. We started a community service group here, and we've raised over $10,000, and that money has gone to give over 3,000 children clean, potable water and throughout India. And also, we've been funding 500 children for 4 years to get a midday meal program, and that's, this lunch meal is probably the only meal they have in the whole day.
I would think that would impress a kid you might meet in the hall at school.
Yeah.
Katie, your thoughts? I mean, here's Smitha. She's just 1 year older than you.
I know.
Doing all this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, she's doing such incredible things. It lets me know what I can do. I
mean, it's great that you got your school to do that, though.
Yeah, it was pretty, it's pretty amazing.
Well, we want to thank you both for speaking to us.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
And wish you the best on this day.
Thank you so much.
Katie Schmidt, a ninth grade student at the Greenwich Country Day School in Connecticut. Smitha Ramakrishna, a high school junior in Phoenix, Arizona, both taking part in Focus the Nation, a nationwide teach-in on global warming. In a minute, a new study that says adults are far less sure about the existence of global warming. And in one town, Choteau, Montana, the superintendent actually canceled a lecture from a Nobel Prize-winning scientist because of protests. We'll have that story in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This month, a brouhaha erupted in the small town of Choteau, Montana, after University of Montana professor Stephen Running, the lead author of research on climate change, who shared the Nobel Peace Prize with Al Gore, was invited to speak. His lecture to students was canceled after some residents objected, and many others then wrote to the local paper to protest the cancellation. 17-year-old Kip Barhar is a senior at Choteau High School. Kip, hi.
Thank you.
You were the one who alerted people to this story because you wrote about it in the Great Falls Tribune. First of all, back us up. Did you know that Dr. Running was coming? Did you have some anticipation that he was coming, and then you heard he was canceled? How did that work?
Well, actually, I did have some anticipation he was coming. The director of the Sonoran Institute here in Choteau.
This is the organization that brought him to town.
Sponsored him, yeah. Well, she got in contact with four high school students, including myself, and she wanted our input as far as what we think he should talk to high school students about, and also what we think he should talk to the community about when he gave his community talk. So there's going to be two talks.
Right. One to the students during the day, one at night. As we said, the one to the students was canceled. The one at night kept on. Now, a school board member is quoted as saying that Dr. Running was invited by the Sonora Institute, and that's a conservationist group, according to another school board member in the group. And the school board member felt that that group is against the town's economic values because this is a ranching and farming town. And that was part of the reason to disinvite Dr. Running. Your thoughts on that?
The thing that really bugged me is, without even having any knowledge of exactly what Dr. Running was going to talk to the students about, the community members felt that they were already being attacked, which wasn't true. Dr. Running, first of all, his message on global warming is not even close towards anti-agriculture. He was really going to talk to students about not so much climate change itself, but about what it, being a climate scientist means, why they should pick science as a college major rather than English.
Can you understand, though, why, you know, if some people fearing, it seems like a fear of the unknown. And
it
felt like, you know, especially hearing from this one school board member that there was, as you said, this feeling that they might be attacked. And here's a town, your town, there's an 11-year drought. We understand some longtime ranchers can't afford to keep their cows anymore. And they might have felt that this is, you know, somehow going to be more of an onslaught against them.
Well, I really think that the global warming issue, I mean, the ranchers should know about it more than anyone because it really affects them. It's going to destroy their crop. It's going to, like, really affect their growing season. It may make it longer, but in the end, it's going to cause the climate to drastically change and really affect their livelihoods.
Well, you know, there was this huge outpouring of letters to the paper. A couple of them, I mean, I'm looking at one where someone says, well, wait a minute, isn't science just a belief like religion? What if we had people come and talk about Christianity? They compared the two. Your thoughts?
I really, that is completely, to me, it's pretty ludicrous. I mean, Christianity as a religion has no evidence to back it up. As in science, everything in science is proven. Scientists don't make wild statements. They prove it.
Well, I understand Dr. Running is only the second Montanan to ever receive a Nobel Prize. You got to see him because you went to the nighttime lecture. Most of your friends probably didn't.
That was pretty unfortunate. I think I saw only four of my classmates there. I would like to think a lot of kids didn't come. It's because there was a basketball game in a neighboring town, and so maybe a lot of those, both boys and girls, couldn't make it because of that. But I thought it was really unfortunate that that many kids didn't really care about this issue. That's really, if you look at it, it's really our generation's problem, because the generation now is going to be gone by the time our generation starts actually feeling the effects. So we better do something now or we're going to be burning up.
Kip Barha, high school senior in Choteau, Montana. He's also a junior editor of the Class Act page in the Great Falls Tribune. Kip, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Well, a new poll just out today finds that just a slim majority of Americans consider global warming a very serious problem, while the kids of those adults surveyed were more likely to see it as a threat. Professor Edward Maybach of George Mason University is senior author of that study. Professor, you asked people whether global warming was a serious problem. They could either agree or disagree, or strongly agree or strongly disagree. What did you find?
What we found is that 62% of the respondents to our survey agreed, 14% disagreed, and almost 1 in 4, 23% specifically, really haven't made up their mind yet on the issue of global warming.
Now, the kids that you spoke to did seem to say that global warming was more of a problem, but you didn't ask them that wide-ranging a question.
We made them take a position. They were more clear in their concern about global warming and somewhat more confident in their personal ability to do things to stop global warming.
This is interesting because they felt that they could and should do something about it. You found that Americans in general that you spoke to supported green actions, you know, buying fuel-efficient cars or using less energy. Are they actually acting on those beliefs?
Well, that was a major finding of our study, is that there's a wide degree of support for 14 different environmental actions that we ask about, but fewer people are actually implementing those actions in their own lives.
Yeah. So given the information that you found, you were surprised at some of it, but are you surprised at stories like the one we just heard of in Choteau, Montana, where adults don't want their kids hearing from, you know, a noted scientist about global warming because they're not sure that it's true?
Well, only 15%, 14-15% of the respondents to our survey said it's not a serious problem. Those 14 or 15% have very strong feelings, and I can understand why it feels somewhat threatening to them to have their children listen to the other side of the issue.
We've been saying in the office that this sort of reflects the polarization in the country in general, in that there are many people who feel that, you know, especially given Al Gore as a figurehead, that this is a political issue, and it's hard for them to cross a political line. Did you find that in your survey?
Republicans are much less likely to see global warming as a threat than are Democrats. They are also less likely to think that there are things we can do to stop it. But what's really interesting is that they're every bit as engaged in performing green behaviors as are Democrats.
Edward Maybach, Director of the Center of Excellence in Climate Change Communication Research at George Mason University. Thanks very much. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, what's it like to play in a Super Bowl? We'll speak with Steve Grogan. He quarterbacked the New England Patriots in Super Bowl 20. It didn't go very well, but still, that's tomorrow. And still ahead today, can your politics get you fired at work? Well, it may depend on where you put that bumper sticker. That's all after the news, Here and Now. What an exciting presidential campaign. A woman, an African-American, a Mormon, a former POW, a Baptist preacher, and a libertarian Republican maverick, all in the running to be the next president of the United States. So much to talk about. But are there places where political talk or demonstration of support for a certain candidate is off limits, even a fireable offense? We have two guests. Bruce Barry is a professor of management and sociology at Vanderbilt University and author of the book Speechless, The Erosion of Free Expression in the American Workplace. Bruce, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
We also welcome back Dr. Bruce Weinstein. He writes the Ethics Guide column for BusinessWeek.com. Dr. Weinstein, always nice to speak with you as well.
Pleasure.
Let's start by talking about the legal rights. And so, Professor Barry, I want to start with you. We've spoken before. You gave us an example of when a political expression may not have been illegal, but it was a fireable offense. It was a bumper sticker?
Well, the bumper sticker case from Alabama about 4 years ago, an employee of a factory had a John Kerry for president bumper sticker on her car. Her boss, the factory owner, a Republican, didn't like it, told her, "You could go work for John Kerry or work for me," wanted her to take off the bumper sticker. She refused and was fired.
Is that legal? Can you do that?
There are some states where it would create some legal problems, but for the most part, it was legal. She lived in Alabama. It was legal there. For the most part, our system of constitutional law and our system of employment law come together to give employers broad rights to regulate the speech of their employees, both on and off the job. That ability to regulate that speech is narrower for people who have government jobs, who work in the public sector, where the state, if you will, is your employer. But in the private sector, you pretty much have very few, if any, free speech rights. For something like a political opinion, a political bumper sticker, on or off the job, in most parts of the country, for most private sector employees, your employer can tell you what to say politically or not to say, if it so chooses.
Well, Dr. Weinstein, I want to turn to you now and just talk a little bit about the ethics. Taking aside any legality, is there a spectrum of ethics here for you? In other words, are there some things that are okay to talk about when it comes to politics and some ways of expressing political opinion that aren't okay?
There are lots of things that we can talk about, but there are four topics that are really so controversial that we really shouldn't talk about them in the workplace, even if we have a right to talk about it. Money, sex, religion, and politics. If we're talking about where we stand on a particular political issue, such as abortion, gay rights, euthanasia, whether the wealthy should be taxed, people feel very strongly about these issues, and they provoke such heated arguments that often devolve into name-calling that these kinds of discussions are just better not had at the workplace.
You're saying that if it happens at work, it can be harmful to the company, to the bottom line.
It can, because let's say that a listener is having a discussion with a colleague about, say, the politics of abortion. The listener feels one way. The person she's talking with feels another way. This argument may provoke such passion that if these two folks are assigned to work on a project together, they both may find it very difficult to work together because of the different political viewpoint. If the topic of conversation is music or literature or food, you have your opinion, I have mine. But when it comes to talking about politics, we tend to believe, rightly or wrongly, that the other person is mistaken.
Well, Professor Barry, I'm going to come back to you then, because doesn't an employer have the right to protect someone from being made uncomfortable by someone else's political opinions at work?
Well, an employer, Robin, has the right to maintain a sort of a reasonably harmonious workplace where people act civilly toward one another. And I agree with Dr. Weinstein that topics like sex and religion and politics can certainly cause disruptions that might even impair job performance or the performance of the organization. But I disagree with him that because those things are conceivably possible, that therefore the workplace is no place for these conversations. Quite simply put, the workplace is where a lot of people live out major parts of their lives. It's where conversations take place.
In fact, I'm going to jump in with a statistic. 40% of Americans apparently now spend 50 or more hours a week in the office.
Yes, and also I would add, for a lot of people, the boundary between what is in fact off work and what's on work is not necessarily all that clear. Even for those where it is clear, my point is that work is where conversations occur. It's where people interact with others who are different from them. And I don't necessarily believe that a conversation on politics is more incendiary than a conversation on, say, the Super Bowl. I'm a New York Giant fan. And the fan of these overrated New England Patriots happens to disagree with me. We could turn it into a sort of a brawl of a verbal encounter.
Well, Dr. Weinstein, what are your thoughts about that? If somebody feels strongly about a candidate, is there a way to express your feelings? For instance, in some companies we read, they require that employees only put posters or campaign buttons inside their office door, if they're lucky to have an office, and not on the front of the office door. You know, is there a way to do it that is more ethical for you?
It just simply behooves us to be respectful of others and not to engage in the kinds of discussion that are likely to provoke loud disagreements that have nothing to do with work. I mean, it's called a workplace for a reason. It's the place where we do work. And if you're talking about a political candidate's position on this issue or that issue, in most workplaces, it has nothing to do with the work at hand and can only interfere with it. As lively and fun as it might be, I agree, these are exciting discussions to have. But we ought not to have them because of the potential downside to them.
I think that it's important to remember that people have conversations that are unrelated to or only marginally related to the task at hand at work all the time. It's part of being a human. It almost infantilizes people's role as employees to suggest that they should completely compartmentalize their lives so that when they walk into the workplace door, they leave behind everything else. Of course, employers have the right to police job performance. And I completely agree with Dr. Weinstein that people should try to hew to norms and ideas of civility. But to say that, therefore, they should avoid discussion topics that could conceivably lead to an incendiary conversation, that's almost sort of a workplace form of prior restraint, which in the rest of society we regard as fundamentally constitutionally unacceptable.
Well, what I'm saying is that it not only could conceivably interfere, it does interfere, and it does so on a wide-scale basis.
What do they tell you? What do you hear, Dr. Weinstein?
I hear people calling one another the worst possible names, which I can't even say on the radio. Ethics really is about looking at the world not as it is, but as it might be, as it could be, as it should be.
Except Dr. Weinstein sounds like he's describing a kind of a form of ethics that would suggest complete control by employers over every minute and every stream of attention by the employee. That's a very command and control form of ethics that sort of denies the humanity of people who come to work, yes, to sell their labor, to sell their time, to sell their effort on behalf of the employer, but not necessarily to sell their souls.
In fact, I argue against the corporate police state. And what I'm really talking about here is individual responsibility and not what the role of the corporation would be. And in other words, there are two questions really on the table here. Do we have a right to have these discussions? And is it right to do it? And even if we have a right to have these discussions, even if it's allowable by our employers, I'm arguing that we ought not to.
Well, gentlemen, I think we're going to have to leave it at that. And I just want to thank you both for having a civil discussion about having political discussions in the workplace. We've been speaking with Dr. Bruce Weinstein. He writes the Ethics Guide column for BusinessWeek.com. And also Bruce Barry, a professor of management and sociology at Vanderbilt University, also author of the book Speechless, The Erosion of Free Expression in the American Workplace. Thank you both, gentlemen, for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you.
So what do you think? Have you been fired for expressing your politics or wanted your boss to muzzle someone who's bugging you with their politics? We'd love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org, letters@here-now.org, or you can call and leave a message, 617-358-0397. You're listening to Here and Now. The recent 2008 Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas was abuzz with the news of an apparent victory in the corporate battle over the next generation digital disc format. Warner Brothers Entertainment, one of the biggest movie studios, announced that starting in June, it will issue its movies in Sony's Blu-ray format instead of Toshiba's HD DVD. That decision means that come summer, three-quarters of all high-def movies will be offered only in Blu-ray. Well, does that also mean the latest high-tech war is over? Maybe not. If you read today's New York Times, you'll see that the manufacturers of DVD players are hedging their bets, offering a new line of machines that will play both discs. And maybe that won't matter either, because as Spectrum Radio's Stephen Cherry explains, the days of any discs are numbered.
One of the few big announcements to come out of this year's Consumer Electronics Show was Sony's victory over Toshiba in the high-definition DVD war. The savviest of shoppers know this as the battle between Blu-ray and HD DVD. Blue light lasers can be aimed more accurately than today's red light lasers, so data can be packed much more densely, putting sharper, clearer images onto the same 5-inch discs we're used to. Both combatants use this one scientific principle, yet created different and incompatible formats. The incompatibility has kept wary consumers from buying either kind of player, frustrating DVD manufacturers and the movie studios who produce the content. And it's not the first time these businesses have been confounded by the incompatibility bugaboo, first with the VCR, then by the switch to DVD. Now they hope we'll buy our movie collections for a third time on high-definition discs. Indeed, the high-def war recalled nothing so much as that first time around. Back in the 1970s, it wasn't until VHS beat out Sony's Betamax that most people bought the bulky video cassettes that let them watch John Travolta strut his stuff on the Saturday Night Fever dance floor from the comfort of their own homes. Sony is the winner this time around, but there's every reason to think its Blu-ray victory will be a Pyrrhic one. There's no guarantee we're going to rebuild our video collections yet again, or if we do, it won't be with thin little platters. The signs are all around us. Let's take a look.
Warner Brothers, Walt Disney, Paramount, Universal, and Sony Pictures. We have every major studio supporting us with 5G movies. And we're going to have all the great first-run films.
At this year's Macworld, Apple CEO Steve Jobs announced a new movie download service. As with music, Apple has carved deals with the major studios. You just go to the iTunes store and rent or buy a movie that you can watch on your computer or hook up to your television or put it on your iPod or iPhone and finish watching it while you're on the run. Apple's biggest competitor may be Netflix, which has deals with all the same studios. Subscribers can view hours and hours of movies and pay nothing more than their current monthly subscription. Finally, Panasonic and Comcast have come up with a removable digital video recorder with its own screen. At home, it's like any DVR you might get from your cable company. But when you and your family go on vacation, just pull it out of its docking station. It comes with a 12-volt car adapter, so the kids can watch in the back seat as well as at the summer cottage.
Just keep swimming, just keep swimming, just keep swimming, swimming, swimming.
Most of these services are limited to regular format movies, while high def takes 5 times as long to transfer. But you can start watching within a minute, though downloading continues in the background.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
So, do we really need to trudge out to Blockbuster, Best Buy, and Walmart for a disc? Or wait for the now familiar red envelope from Netflix? A lot of companies, including Apple and Netflix itself, are betting no. Sony and the studios hope they're wrong. But my bet is, they're not. And if I'm right, It's a lot easier and cheaper to recycle ones and zeros than vinyl, videotape, or shiny DVD discs.
Stephen Cherry of Spectrum Radio, the broadcast edition of IEEE Spectrum. That's the magazine of technology insiders. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. And coming up, we're going to meet the nation's first ambassador for young people's literature, children's author John Cheska. Yeah, the Stinky Cheese Man. That's in 1 minute, here and now. Children's author John Cheska now has an additional job. Earlier this month, the Library of Congress named Cheska the first national ambassador for young people's literature. He's known for his offbeat children's favorites, The True Story of the Three Little Pigs and The Stinky Cheese Man and Other Fairly Stupid Tales. He's also a former school teacher who now runs a literacy program and a website, Guys Read, to get boys to read more. But wait, there's more. Cheska also has a project designed to appeal to pre-kindergarten readers. It's called Truck Town. It's the world of talking trucks. The first book in the series, Smash Crash, has just been published. And John Cheska joins us from the NPR studios in Culver City, California. Welcome, Ambassador Cheska.
Thanks, Robin, and I like the way you say Ambassador Cheska.
How's it feel? What you been doing? I mean, have you been ambassador-like?
I have been very ambassadorial, though I'm waiting for my helicopter, which I've asked the Library of Congress to get for me.
Well, I'm thinking there's very few ambassadors who can claim creating characters like Little Red Running Shorts or Really Ugly Duckling, some of your past characters. Let's talk about your goal to get boys to read more first. What is the challenge with boys?
Well, I found as a teacher that boys were just not connecting with books. They weren't getting to read what they liked, and it was this vicious circle of them not really liking what they were reading, so they read less and got worse at it.
Because what? I mean, someone noted, I don't know if you said this, if Little House on the Prairie is on their reading list, there's a good chance that they're not going to want to read that.
Yeah, in fact, that happened to my son in third grade. That was the one required reading book. So he just thought, wow, if that's reading, I'm not really that crazy about reading.
So how do you change that? Because, you know, you want him to read classics, but what would you pick?
Yeah, well, as, you know, having been both a parent and then a teacher for 10 years, I've found a couple things we can do really quickly is engage more kids just by sort of expanding our definition of what we call reading. I mean, we need to include nonfiction, humor, fantasy, science fiction, comics. I think they can start at almost anything.
But is it, you know, video screens? I mean, isn't that one of the problems? That's boys in particular. I mean, they've got Wii's now.
Well, that is a big piece of it. There's a lot of things competing for their attention. But I think along those lines, too, we should probably not really demonize those technologies. Like, let's not make computers and TV the bad guy. Because kids are reading online, and they live online. I think if we can make a case for what reading can do that can't be done in those other media, that'll make sense to kids.
Well, let's talk about Truck Town, because this is your new project, in part, to get kids to read. And you've brought in all sorts of artists to do this series. Actually, we have the books in front of us. Maybe we could do a little bit of reading from your new book, Smash Crash. From
that would be a good action demonstration.
Yes, let's do that.
Well, actually, because this came out of all my experiences with those things, with getting kids excited about reading. Because the idea is to make the story just so compelling that it can live in all these different places, that it can be books, it can be TV, it can be online.
Well, it features Jack and Dan. I'll play the part of Dan.
Okay.
And we should say the drawings are huge, very, you know, primary colors, these big talking trucks with their red and yellow and blue and big wheels on them and big, everything big. That's what the image is.
Big and colorful and smashing right off the page.
That's right.
Jack Truck, Dump Truck Dan. Best friends, Jack and Dan.
What should we do, Jack?
What we always do, Dan.
Smash, crash. That's a whole page of smashing and crashing. And then?
And then a shadow falls. A big voice calls, "Hey, you two. Jack and Dan hit the road.
Uh-oh.
Gotta go."
And off they go.
And they just go racing off through Tucktown for the rest of the book, just trying to get all their friends smashing and crashing.
Now, how did you, this is for pre-kindergartners. I mean, everybody knows that they love to, like, pile five blocks and then smash them, crash them down. Yeah. But, I mean, did you have to do any research also to come
up with? Oh, absolutely, yeah. Because I never taught kids this young, though I had kids that young, but I completely blocked that out of my memory just for survival, I think. So I went and worked with a class of pre-K kids in Brooklyn right near my house. And, in fact, that's who the book is dedicated to, every one of those kids. I had put their name on the front.
What did they teach you?
Well, they taught me, once again, how smart kids are. I mean, they can't always communicate that to us in the way that we might communicate. But, man, they are incredible learners. I mean, if we were learners like that through our whole life, we'd all be geniuses.
Meaning what? I mean, we stop at some point? Or?
Yeah, you know, I think we end up getting stopped by other people or by setups. Like, just the way school is set up, I think it sort of takes kids' excitement out of the learning. And if we could just let kids play around, they learn crazy stuff by playing. And that's kind of the message of Trucktown, is like, you can play around and learn. In fact, you should play around and learn.
Does it ever get too, you know, silly? I don't know that you can be too silly, but, you know, one review of your fairy tales book said it should have been subtitled All Things Gross and Giddy, you know, and there's, you know, there's parents who are like, gosh, my kids only want to read Captain Underpants or Everybody Farts or, you know, in this attempt to get kids to read, they're not reading the Treasure Island classics, you know?
Yeah. No, and I understand why parents are nervous about that and teachers, because you don't want your kid just reading fart books forever. But I kind of pride myself in not going to that easy, gross humor. And I've definitely found kids, they'll become obsessed over, say, like a Captain Underpants, but they'll move on by themselves.
What were your favorite books or the books that most inspired you when you were a young adult?
Well, the one book I started with was Go, Dog, Go, which was just the craziest book. Just I loved that it was a bunch of different colored dogs driving around in cars who ended up having a party in a tree. I mean, that's just a perfect book in my mind.
Parents are making a list. Go, Dog, Go, that's P.D. Eastman.
Yeah, and all of Dr. Seuss. I just loved his voice that I recognized even though I didn't know what a voice was or a writer was. Yeah. I just realized his books were different from those Dick and Jane books I was reading in school.
You also told Newsweek that Tristram Shandy by Lawrence Stern helped inform your Stinky Cheese Man.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the original kind of metafiction novel. It's all about telling the story. And in fact, he has blank pages in there. One page that's completely black because he doesn't want to offend the reader. And just the narrative jumps all over the place. So I definitely modeled Stinky on that.
John Cheska is the author of the new book Smash Crash, part of a new series for kids. But he's also been named the Library of Congress's new ambassador for young people's literature. Ambassador Cheska, you mentioned two ways to get kids reading. What was the second one? Because, you know, I would think maybe just giving a kid a book at night would, you know, you see it happen. It's like magic. They love it. But if it's not, what's another way to get a child to read?
I think that one way would be to really find what interests them. Like, give them a voice in all of this. I think too often we're just dictating to them what they should be reading. And if you have a little reader who's just a fan about sharks, don't read Goodnight Moon. You can read The Big Book of Sharks. Don't feel like you have to be reading Swiss Family Robinson. You can read all about Captain Underpants, and that's okay.
Yeah, and then go take the Swiss Family Robinson and read it to yourself, because that's what you wanted anyway.
Yeah, if that's what you wanted to read, you go ahead and read that, exactly.
John Cheska, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, and Hitesh Hathi. Doug Sugertz is our engineer, assisted today by Vince Fairchild. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns are Kate Tai and Lisa Tobin. Our managing editor is Chris Ballman, and the senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.